This episode of Literary Treks is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for your desktop or mobile device. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. Also, help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day by becoming a Trek FM patron through Patreon. Get access to exclusive content and become part of the team. You'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Taking all these books?
I thought I'd take some light reading, in case I got bored.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Literary Treks, your dedicated Star Trek books and comics show here on Trek FM. I'm one of your hosts, Dan Gunther, and joining me, as he always is Bruce Gibson. Bruce, how are you today?
I'm having, like, an off day. Everything's just been a little weird today, and I'm just off. I don't even know if I'm really here right now, or maybe I'm some alternate Bruce from another timeline or alternate universe. I'm not really sure, but at least I'm familiar with the show to know that you're a common thing that I can always count on to be here, and nothing has changed. It's the same old literary treks, and that makes me feel good.
Exactly. Well, I mean, I don't exactly know where you are, but wherever you are, I'm there with you. This has been a bit of a crazy week, but the one constant in our life is talking about Star Trek books and comics. And we've also got a special guest joining us this week.
Oh, good. Matthew Rushing's here again?
I know what everyone out there is thinking. Exactly. Matthew's back again. He said he'd stay away, but actually, no, it's not Matthew. We have a new face sitting out there. Why don't you introduce yourself?
I'm not a new face. I've been here before. But you weren't here when I was here before, Dan. Bruce is here. We talked about an Enterprise novel.
Oh, that's right. True. That's why. Okay. Yeah.
That was like spring of last year.
It was like a year ago.
Like,
and I actually, yeah. I was so busy at that time. I was knee deep in this rewatch, and I almost didn't have time to read the book. So I called in sick. So I could read the novel, so I could make sure that I was on Literary Treks that day. And I read like 400 pages of that novel that day.
I remember that. Yeah, you called in sick and you spent the whole day
reading the book. I'm so glad my boss doesn't listen to this podcast.
That is dedication. That is so dedication there. See, already my day was getting better because now having Brandon on, I thought, oh my gosh, now that's really throwing me off in this strange day because I'm not used to Brandon being on. But I am because we did that one time and. You're so dedicated, so we're good. We're good. I like this.
I guess I'll introduce myself. It's Brandon from Melodic Treks and Warp 5.
Excellent. Well, it's great to have you on the show. And I have to say, if I were your boss, being sick to read a Star Trek novel, I'd accept
that.
Oh,
good. You should tell all bosses that. I would just call in sick all the time. Excellent. And read Star Trek books all the time.
No, that's not a bad idea.
I'm really confused, though. Like, this is a Literary Trek show. I don't know why you wanted to talk about this season 2 episode of Deep Space Nine, the third part of a 3-part series. Why did you want to talk about this episode?
Yeah, definitely. The Siege, when I was, that's the novel we're going to be talking about
novel.
Today. Every time I Googled The Siege, Deep Space Nine, that damn episode came up. But no, it's not the episode. It's a novel. It's...
Wait. Because Brandon took the day off today to watch that one episode.
It took me all day to watch that episode.
That's a good episode. But unfortunately, not what we're talking about today. Or fortunately, I don't know. But first, actually, in the news, we do have a couple of comics that we want to talk about. Some new releases in the comic world. First up is Boldly Go number 5. You might remember issues 1 through 4 were that Borg story that we definitely had some mixed feelings about. But Boldly Go number 5 takes a different tack and starts a new story off with one of my favorite characters, Jayla. What did you guys think of this comic?
I loved it. I mean, this was a great comic for a couple reasons. One, It's Jayla. Okay, more than a couple reasons. Two, it's her backstory. And three, it was all self-contained story. And number four, it was a good story. I really enjoyed it. Brandon, what did you think of it?
I thought it was pretty interesting. I was a little bit thrown off by the format of the storytelling at first, because they start, they tell a couple of pages like just before Star Trek Beyond, and then they tell a couple pages just before that, and then a couple pages just before that. And so it slowly goes back in time throughout the whole comic book. And honestly, it felt like I was reading, you know, a different version of the episode Voyager's episode Before and After, where Kes starts growing young after she gets old. Like, that's kind of how it felt, because they just kept jumping backwards and backwards. So I don't know, the format of the story was a little bit odd, and it took me a while to kind of get into it, but I really did enjoy the story. I thought it was good. Considering on the digital copy that we have, where they've got all the covers and how page two has a picture of Scotty on it, I was a little bit surprised that Scotty wasn't even in the comic, but you know, but it was good. I liked it.
Yeah, I had much the same thought you did. I was totally thinking of Before and After as well, and I was waiting to see the doctor show up with hair or something, but yeah, no, it was definitely a different way to do it, and a little bit jarring at first, but once you get into the story, I really ended up enjoying this one as well. We go right back to Jayla's birth and how she's going to be the fierce one, and I think she definitely lives up to her name in Star Trek Beyond, and I'm really excited to see where her story goes in the rest of the Boldly Go series.
I feel like I read a story like this before recently in a Star Trek comic where it did this, kept going back in time. I don't know what it was, but when I was reading this, it seemed familiar to me, as if we'd seen this somewhere else in a recent Star Trek comic. And maybe it wasn't Star Trek, but that's really the only comics I've been reading the last year or so is Star Trek. Surprise, surprise. But
imagine that.
But I mean, even the likeness of the characters of Jayla looks great in here. And I just really enjoyed finding out how she ended up on this planet and where she came from before, and especially the very last page of this and how it ended, not in the past, but in the current situation that she's in. Let's just put it that way.
Well, there was also another comic that we got the opportunity to look at this week, and this one is the second issue of the Stranger Worlds miniseries, which is the third issue of the second Green Lantern comic series. It's too many numbers. It's hard to keep track of here. But yeah, and it's the second Green Lantern series, third issue. And this one was extra special because before we even get into the story, we should point out there's this beautiful variant cover done by none other than Trek FM's own Aaron Harvey.
Ooh, yeah. Look at that. Variant cover from a Trek FM person.
Yeah, how cool is that? And it's a beautiful cover, too. I really like this one. It's really bold with those green colors and the Enterprise and the Green Lantern coming up through the middle. Just gorgeous. So shout out to you, Aaron. Nice job.
Yeah, and in the background, there's a bunch of stars. And I saw somewhere where he pointed out that he slipped in a Trek FM little Delta shield somewhere in the background, and also a little Bonaventure from the animated series. And I can't.
Yeah, I saw he'd posted that. It's absolutely minuscule on this cover, so it's really hard to find. But once you find where they are, you'll see them. But trust me when I say they're very tiny on there. Very hard.
See, I saw where he posted it on the Babel conference, but I don't see it on my digital copy here. I'm zooming it, and I saw where he enlarged it. I just don't see him on here.
Yeah, I'm having a hard time too.
The Delta, for example, like, it just looks like another star, but it's okay. If you look in the bottom left hand corner, go straight up from the DC, there's a star.
Oh, there it is over there. Yeah. Okay. I see it. Yep.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
That second one is it. And then the Bonaventure is somewhere off on the right.
Oh, it's off on the right. It's if you go on the planet there's like a Aaron's initials and there's a planet, and you go straight up from there and there's like a bend in the green light. It's kind of in the middle of the grooves, so I can see it there too. Yeah, cool.
Yeah, if you're looking at it from a distance, it kind of looks like just a slightly elongated star, and once you see that there's one that's not perfectly round, that's the one you're looking
Congratulations,
for.
Congratulations, Aaron.
Yeah, very cool. We're fans of this cover.
Yeah, we can't wait to get our autographed covers from you. Hint, hint.
So moving on from that, what did you guys think of the story?
You know, again, I'm really liking these Star Trek Green Lantern stories. And I'm even loving this more because my daughter was seeing me reading this and she's a big DC fan. And I mean, she likes the new Star Trek, the Kelvin timeline movies, but she saw me reading this and she says, wait, that's Green Lantern with Star Trek? That looks really cool. Wait, is that like the same like actors from the movies? And I'm like, yeah, it is. She's like, oh, that's so cool. And I said, do you want to read it? She's like, yeah. And I'm like, oh, she's going to read her first Star Trek. Even though Green Lantern's in it, it's like half of the, it's just Star Trek, but you know, it's something Star Trek that she's actually going to read, which she told me she would never do. So I hope she doesn't listen to this because then she'll hear me say that and she'll say, oh, you know what? You're right. I shouldn't read it.
Well, that's the kind of thing, like, I got to think the folks at IDW just love to hear that. Because, you know, that's a new potential customer and there might be more people out there.
What if she loves it? What if she loves Star Trek after reading it? She starts reading the others. So, you know, I even showed her the Jayla and I could tell she was somewhat interested in that one, too. So we'll see what happens. But I will say I have to correct something because I'm not a perfect person. I know, Dan, you're surprised by this. I am not perfect. So I have said, yeah, I know. Exactly.
All of my everything I've based my life on is just shattered.
I'm so sorry. Don't cry. We'll work through it. But I misread something. I read that the volume one graphic novel was coming out in April, but I didn't realize it was April 2016. I kept thinking it was coming out this April, but it already came out. And thank you, Jared Cooper, for pointing that out to me. And so I read volume one just the other day. So I'm all caught up on Star Trek Green Lantern.
Excellent.
So that Very being cool. said, I've liked this issue and so far I've liked them all.
Excellent. So Brandon, what are your thoughts on Stranger Worlds issue 3?
I thought it was an interesting idea. Like, how much can we talk about it here?
Yeah, I think generally speaking, we don't give away the ending. But, okay,
so can I say that Khan's in here?
Okay. Yeah, because he showed up at the end of the last issue. So
Khan getting this ring, I think, is pretty cool, and it's a neat twist on it. It's a way to keep it fresh and a way to keep it new Star Trek and a way to keep it interesting. So I thought that was really, really good. All that I've read exactly now 9 comics that have the Green Lantern in them, and all 9 of them also happen to have Star Trek people in them. So I don't know much of the Green Lantern stuff myself and the Green Lantern history. I haven't seen the movie or anything, but I'm enjoying it. And I think they've done a really good job of making it accessible for somebody that doesn't know the other franchise.
Yeah, Brandon, you and I are once again in the same boat because all of these issues are all I've ever seen of the Green Lantern. I haven't even seen the film. So I knew nothing about him or that universe going into this. And you're absolutely right. They've made it a really cool way to kind of introduce that world and have these two worlds come together. And as someone who isn't familiar with all of that, I find that very, very helpful and very considerate, you know, because it's actually made me very interested in this universe. And, you know, maybe I'll check something out in Green Lantern that doesn't feature Kirk and Spock.
I like the look of this guy in green that's like, he's got like a pink head and he's really large.
Oh man, I'm so sorry. I don't remember what his name is.
Yeah, I don't know either. I didn't catch it, but I don't know. I like the look of that guy. I think it's interesting. Like this, I'm going off on a tangent here because I don't know this stuff, but there's a whole bunch of people that are wearing green. So, you know, I guess there's more than one Green Lantern, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, so you have several Green Lanterns, and then there can also be several Blue Lanterns and Purple Lanterns, and each ring, and there's red and yellow. And the red and yellow are more the aggressive and the more mean people seem to get chosen by those rings. And a lot of this I'm speaking from just reading the Volume 1 recently. Mm-hmm. So it was explaining how the different color rings, it goes and finds the right people that sets it fits more comfortable with. So the red is looking for somebody who's aggressive and has got a lot of anxiety and is evil and whatever. So of course the red ring in this issue chooses Khan. Mm-hmm. And we have the augments here, which we didn't see in the Kelvin timeline. We're now seeing them here. And one of my favorite lines is this: after the ring chooses Khan, he turns to his people and says, My appearance has changed since you last saw me centuries ago. It's like, yeah, you're some white guy with a British accent now.
Yes. See Con issue one.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Because you got to think all these guys being woken up are like, okay, so who's this guy? What's going on here?
Yeah, and they're like, oh, okay, he says he's Con, so I guess he's Con. We'll follow him.
Works for me.
I mean, he squished that guy's head, so yeah, he's probably Con. Well, we'll go with that. Yeah, he's Con. I'm good. But also, to be able to read this comic and picture and hear Benedict Cumberbatch's voice in your head, you know, that's a special treat too, because, you know, he's pretty awesome.
Did you like his line? Shall we continue?
Yeah, exactly. I thought that was, yeah, a nice little nod, a little bit on the nose, but yeah, it's pretty good. Well, if you'd like to get into contact with us on anything we talk about in this show, like the Green Lantern comics, if you love Con in it, if you hate Con in it, if you want to talk about Aaron Harvey's awesome cover, you can get in contact with us on the Trek FM website. Go to trek.fm/contact. You can leave us a voicemail. Just look in the sidebar on the show page or go to speakpipe.com/trekfm. You can find us on Twitter @trekfm and on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm. While you're on Facebook, check out the Babel Conference. Just type the Babel Conference, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook. Or you can go to our website at trek.fm and click discussion on the menu bar. Now, Bruce, where's another great place on the internet for listeners of Literary Treks to engage with the show?
The great place would be Goodreads. Maybe we should call it Great Reads, but it's called Goodreads. And if you're not on Goodreads, then I encourage you, if you're a reader of books and you like to read reviews and maybe discuss and follow what other people are reading, go to goodreads.com and set up an account. And when you're there, look for us at Literary Treks, and you can join our group. You just go in there and you click to join the group, and then we get an email alerting us, and more than likely, we will approve you. And then, of course, and the reason we don't approve you, well, then there must be something really wrong.
It's because you have a red ring.
Exactly.
Ah, yep.
A red ring, and you don't look like yourself. So then we'll let you in the group, and then you can join any of the discussions on the Star Trek books and keep up to see what we have coming up in future episodes that we will be reading and discussing.
Also, if you say in your profile that you hate the Vanguard novels, I might not approve you, but Bruce or Matt probably will, so it's okay.
I won't. No. No, I'm kidding.
All right. Well, why don't we jump into the discussion and talk about The Siege? Not the episode, the book. Well, for this episode, we got the chance to read a classic Deep Space Nine episode. This one is from the very early days of the Deep Space Nine novel series. In fact, it's the second novel, Deep Space Nine number 2, The Siege, by none other than veteran Star Trek author Peter David. So, first off, The Siege. What's it all about?
You said we read a classic episode. We did not read a classic episode. It just says.
Did I say episode?
You did, yeah.
Brandon, you've got me doing it.
No, it's not an
episode. You got me all turned around on this.
Yes, there was an episode, but it's with the same name, but that's not this book. And yeah, this was the second book. So this book came out in 93, and I remember buying this because the first book was The Emissary. It was the novelization of the pilot episode, and I read that at the time. And then this book came out sometime a few months after or so. It's really interesting because I don't remember a lot of details about this book the first time I read it because it was such a long time ago. So I don't remember what my impressions of it were then, but it's interesting to read a book now that the series has been on. We've gone through 7 seasons and we've known this series for years and years. And it's like, okay, so how does a book that was written with only a few episodes under its belt, how does it hold up today? And we'll reveal that as we talk through this. But Peter David is one of my favorite authors. And so I was very happy to read this once again.
Yeah, it's been a long time since I've read it. I bought it originally when it came out as well. You know, I've always bought the books as soon as they've come out. And it's like you say, it's weird because there's so many references to a few first season episodes. Like he says in the opening preface to it, he's like, I had access to the first 5 or 6 episodes in the Bible, and that's all that I could reference. I couldn't reference anything past that. And he referenced all of them. Like, he dropped as much information on the previous episodes as he possibly could. Like, Memory Beta had this as a release date of May 1st, 93, which is just after the episode Battle Lines, which was episode number 13. If you count Emissary as 2, it was episode 13. You know, so this is really early in its run. And me, like you, it's Peter David. He's one of my favorite Trek authors. And I remember loving it, but there was things in this book that I had gotten confused with other books of the time period, like the Borg ship in the very first, like the very beginning. I actually thought that was from the next novel, Bloodletter, which was by K.W. Jeter. So I had was actually pleasantly surprised that it was in this book. But yeah, because it's been so long since I've read all of them, right?
But now, didn't you tell me the other day that you've read this book more than once? Not counting this time, but you read it a few times.
Yeah, I think this is the fourth time I've actually read this book. I've always loved this book, and it's been one of my favorite Deep Space Nine novels. I've really enjoyed it. And it is interesting, like you said, how does it hold up, you know, 20-some years later here now, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's been a long time. I mean, even my cover is starting to change colors on the inside because it's so old. But it's also interesting, this book. I mean, obviously, I think you're going to give it a good rating, Brandon, when we get to the end of the show. But this was
spoiler alert.
This was your suggestion. We read this because you picked it.
Yeah, well, and I picked it because, well, there's a couple reasons why I picked it. You know, I've listened to just about all the episodes of Literary Treks. Now, I fell behind a bit on last year's rewatch when I was doing the From There to Here. But you know, you guys haven't covered a lot of Peter David novels, and he's such a great author, and you haven't covered a lot of really early novels. So I thought it would be fun to do that. And so the reason why I picked this one, though, as well, is because it is one of my favorite Star Trek novels, and it's one that I've read multiple times. I think this is probably the Star Trek book that I've actually read the most.
Very cool. Well, this is, you know, different from the two of you. I have never read this book before. So this was my first time reading this novel. And I love that there are so many older novels that I've never read. And it's fun to read them because it's a little glimpse back into that early period of time in Deep Space Nine. And, you know, for the fact that it was written before the show even aired, and he only had access to the materials that the show was kind of built around, it's really evocative of the first season of Deep Space Nine. I feel like Peter David really managed to kind of channel the mood and tone, for the most part, that we got during that season. So this was a really enjoyable read for me. You know, a few issues with it that we'll get to in the discussion, I'm sure, but definitely first impressions, a lot better than what I was expecting.
That's great, because, you know, when it comes to these early novels, when they're written in a first season, they don't always match up well with what we learn of the characters as the series progresses. Like, for example, I think the first couple books or so, The Next Generation, there's scenes where Troy refers to Will Riker as Bill, and it's throughout the book where she says, you know, oh, Bill, how are you, or whatever. And that's, of course, you know, we've never heard Troy call Riker Bill. It was always Will. So
just once in the Naked Time, well, if you're listening carefully.
That's true, yeah.
But yeah, they got rid of that pretty quickly.
But there's other things that, you know, you'll read and it's like, well, that character doesn't quite match up, or, oh, you know, I don't think they quite got, yeah, they went in a different, the author didn't know Data well enough, and so Data has more emotion than he did in the series, whatever it was. But in my opinion, and of course I want to hear what you guys think, I thought all these characters were spot on. There was nothing really in this novel that stood out like big to me that I would say like, no, this doesn't fit right in the DS9 that we know today. I thought all the characters sounded great. I thought their interactions were perfect. There were several times I busted out laughing out loud, and I usually don't do that when I read a novel.
There was one line in here that maybe I just read it wrong. It's right in chapter one when he says, Miles O'Brien, square-jawed, curly-haired, and the most aggressively patient individual on Deep Space Nine, smiled broadly, which was the only way he was capable of smiling. That's the only, like, he did capture O'Brien well, but that description doesn't quite seem right to me. So, unless you're, like, aggressively patient, you're just, like, like, is that aggressively patient? Or I don't know, like, what do you think aggressively patient means?
And also not something that I would really ascribe to O'Brien. Like, I've seen him kind of lose his temper a little
bit. So is that aggressively patient? Is that like an oxymoron where he's saying he's not patient at all? So
yeah, I don't know.
And then the only weird line right there, too, was when he was trying to show this trick to Keiko. And she's like, I wouldn't kick a small dog while it's down or something. And I'm like, what the heck kind of line is that?
Well, Keiko always says something weird anyway, you know. Well, so, but going back to what you're saying about Bashir, that doesn't even match up with what happens in the novel, because that leads then
O'Brien.
Later to a scene. Oh, I'm sorry, O'Brien, what did I say?
Bashir,
yeah. We'll get to Bashir later. But O'Brien, later in the novel, gets into a real, like, shouting match with Sisko, which I thought was a little uncharacteristic for O'Brien, but just the way they're kind of going at each other just felt like it was a little, maybe too much for those characters.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's a couple of misses in here, but honestly, for the most part, this really did feel like a good season one episode. Like, it could have been an episode. You know, the characters were pretty much spot on. There was a few misses, but again, you got to give the guy, I would never hold that against the book, especially considering the fact this was written before it aired, you know. The only character that I think he really missed the mark on was Ducat, but again, we had only seen Ducat in the pilot by this point. I don't think we saw Ducat again for a little while in season one, if at all again in season one. But so honestly, I give props to writing such a well-fitting novel.
Agreed. Yeah, there are a lot of. And it's actually funny what you say about Ducat, too, because later in the novel, I think he's very out of character. There's some things, but a particular line here and there when he first shows up, when he's communicating with Sisko, boy, did it ever feel like Ducat. Like, it's funny how many, there are many more hits, I think, in this book than misses. There are a few things I did, and I mean, this is being really picky, early in the novel, I think Sisko said damn it or damn like every third word or something. And it kind of leapt off the page to me. I was like, that's okay, it's a little weird. Like, yeah, he's got that hard streak to him, but it just seemed a little out of place.
But
a few
he's
times.
Done that in the show though too, you know? Like, there was that one scene where we've had some damn good fights when he was talking about working with the Bajorans and stuff, you know? So I think that was in Homecoming. Like, I think that was actually in the three-parter when he said that. But, you know, like, I don't know, that even there didn't seem too much out of character for Sisko, for early Sisko.
No, it just to me felt like a little bit too much. Like, he saw that in the script a couple times and then just leapt on that. And there was like five of them in two pages or something. And I'm going, okay, yeah, no, that's a bit much.
Yeah, I thought it all tasted good. I'm just thinking, Dan, as you're talking, it's like when you're eating something really good and maybe there's just one bite was like, that was a little strange, it was a little off. That's how I feel this book was. Like, for the most part, it all was, well, it was just one little bite that maybe not.
It's like a bag of potato chips. They're all good. And then you get that one chip that's burnt and you're just like, I'll eat it anyways.
How did you know I do that?
Because I do it. Everybody does it. Who's going to waste a chip?
Because everybody does that. Chip? Exactly. But yeah, no, that's very true. And it goes back to what I was saying. Like, I was expecting this to be very much an early TNG novel, which, or like that early DC miniseries from TNG, where they're just like, wow, this is way out there and nothing like the show. But, you know, reading it, it was really great. It really matched up in a lot of cases. The other one that I thought a couple times just slipped a bit out of character was Odo, but I think that was just due to the fact that so much of the story focused on him. That, you know, there's going to be a few notes that just don't quite fall correctly. But I mean, like I said, that's being very, very picky. And for the most part, this was really good. This was much better than I was expecting character wise.
Yeah, I kept expecting Keiko to call O'Brien Bill because it's the first season. But no, let me just go to this because I said, you know, there's several things in here that makes me laugh and I feel like the characters are spot on. And I usually don't read from a book on the show and I'm not going to read much. I'm just kind of paraphrase through some of this. But okay, so there's a scene where Quark and this other Ferengi named Glav, they come up to Ops. And Kira's like, you know, okay, guys, you're clogging up Ops. Get out of here. And then Dax, very diplomatically, she turns to them and says, well, may I help you? And Glav says, in ways that you could not possibly dream. And Quark is like, this is Lieutenant Dax. Dax, this is Glav. And Glav is like, a beautiful woman covered from head to toe in clothing. You Starfleet women certainly know how to tease. And Dax is like, Kira is fully clothed as well. You made no such remarks about her. And Glav blew air through his lips, goes, psh, Bajoran women, ice princesses, the lot of them. It's said that their noses look that way because they're so used to wrinkling them in disgust at the thought of sex. And Kira's like, okay, that's it. Security! I was like, I could so see this scene on Deep Space Nine.
Absolutely.
Totally. Like, season one Kira, where, for example, in Battle Lines, she comes out of the office just raving mad about how she's described in an old Cardassian file. Like, that. That when her voice goes up like that, that's totally how I read that scene. That was perfect. Excellent. Well, moving on from that, one thing that I kind of noticed about this story, and I'm not saying that I was put off by it or anything like that. It was kind of, it fit the tone of the story. But did you guys notice that the story seemed to be a lot more violent than the typical Star Trek story? Yeah, it definitely
is. Have you
is.
Read and, New and, like, Frontier,
not,
man?
Not just violent, but like graphically.
Have
so.
You read New Frontier? That's Peter David, man.
Oh, yeah.
Like that's, I like the New Frontier novels and I like Peter David, but his books are like crazy graphic violent, you know, and which is so odd for Star Trek. So I don't know. To me, that's just Peter David.
I just, you know, some of the stuff, and I thought it brought an interesting tone to this, especially given that Deep Space Nine at the beginning was described as, you know, the darker, grittier Star Trek. So I thought maybe Peter David was really, really channeling that idea too. I mean, you've got a serial killer changeling, maybe, who's, you know, writing number two, number three on the walls in blood, you know, just stuff that you wouldn't see on the show at all that I thought lent this novel a really dark tone that was a lot of fun to read.
Yeah, I felt that if Deep Space Nine were rated PG, this would have been a PG-13. I mean, it wasn't like it was too violent or too graphic. There were just certain scenes, and like you said, the number one, number two, number three written in blood. I think one of the most grossest things is when this spoiler alert,
it's like a head on the table.
What?
There was like a scene where the woman's head's cut off and put on the table.
Well, yeah, there was that. But I was thinking about when the changeling goes into, well, okay.
I fear for your children.
Hey, have you seen PG? Have you seen Gotham? I mean, come on. You see stuff like that on Gotham. But the changeling goes into the Cardassian, basically blows him up.
Yeah.
Like, going inside of him.
It's, I mean, down his, it was throat.
Just, like, yeah, there was just a few little scenes like that, yeah, were pushing it. But the rest of it felt like an episode to me.
Yeah, definitely. And like I said, it's not something that put me off or anything like that. You know, it was a nice. it was an interesting, bloody change in tone.
And I liked it.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it lent itself well to the tone of the novel. And I think Peter David did a really interesting job of making that universe seem a lot darker than it usually is.
And sexier, because he does include, there weren't any sex scenes in here, but as Brando was pointing out, you know, the way Peter David writes, he does put more sexuality into some of his books. And, you know, Quark and Glav are on the holodeck playing, what is it, program
XXX3.
XXX3. And Kira and Dax are, I guess they don't wear clothes. Or they're dancing. No, they're dancing.
And the clothes come off.
They come off, yes. Yeah. And Bashir walks in. And I was like, I wanted such a bigger reaction from Bashir, and we didn't get that. I was a little disappointed from that.
Yeah, it's kind of too bad that it, you know, things come to a head right then and there, you know, so the changeling or the changeling in quotes attacks. So we don't really get to see his immediate reaction to that beyond just, you know, that few seconds. So when he comes down hard on them later about it, you know, yeah, I would have loved to have seen a little bit more of the shock that moment would have caused.
You would have loved to have seen
sure.
a little bit more of the program, too.
Well,
Well, you do have to visualize what you're reading in your head. So Dan reread that scene several times.
It was, I actually had a bit of a hard time reading that scene because all I could picture Kira was just like being so pissed off at the circumstances. I was like, I can't see it. True. Like, it's just not. Yeah. Yeah. Those dirty, dirty Ferengi. Ugh. So another aspect of this story is the religious pilgrims or the missionaries that come aboard the station. And they want to go through the wormhole, but the wormhole is currently closed because, you know, a Borg ship came through it and was destroyed. So it's doing something that's crushing ships and it's being all dangerous. Let's actually just for a second talk about the Borg coming through the wormhole. At first, when I read this, I thought, wait, the Borg? Deep Space Nine? Like, what's going on here? But then, almost brilliantly, the novel kind of takes care of it with Sisko explaining to Jake, you know, setting his mind at ease. Well, the Borg went through this thing and one of their ships was destroyed, so they'll never go through it again. Like, they'll just steer clear of it. And I was like, oh,
yeah,
problem solved. That's why they never show up in Deep Space Nine again.
I thought that was brilliant. I mean, the same thing. I'm like, okay, so we have Borg coming through the wormhole and get destroyed. Okay. Like, it didn't bother me, but it was like, you know, we typically don't see the Borg, even though they're in the very first opening shot of the Emissary. But regardless of that, we don't really see Borg anymore in Deep Space Nine. So we introduce them here, they get destroyed. And then when that's explained, it's like, well, that's why we haven't seen Borg. And kudos to Peter David to predict that 7 seasons later, we will not see Borg. And they're like, they'll never come through here. Just imagine if Borg did show up on Deep Space Nine, then Peter David would be like, ah, screw it. That just ruined my whole novel.
I do kind of wonder why they're not a little bit more worried that Borg cubes seem to be kind of just tooling around the Gamma Quadrant, but, you know, that's okay. We'll forgive them that. So getting back to the religious missionary story. So they're stuck on the station because they can't go through the wormhole, and they have this leader, Maz Marco, who's, you know, a little bit of kind of this fundamentalist guy. Again, they're not really pushing their religion on other people, but they're being very they're doing missionary work. They're evangelists and trying to encourage people to join their faith on the promenade. They have a little stand set up, and they notice the crew notices that one of the members of this group seems kind of sickly, and it's Maz Marco's son. Now he has a disease called Panoria, and he's very close to death. You know, he's only a few months away, few years at the outside of dying from this disease. But the followers of this religion believe that it is the will of their god. I'm going to say Kolker is kind of how,
that's
how
I said it
pronouncing
too, yeah.
It. Yeah. It's his will that, you know, all things are his will. And this kid has this disease. So obviously their god wants that to happen. And he will join them in their version of heaven and that sort of thing. But Bashir, of course, can't sit idly by and watch this happen. So he kind of goes to some, you know, broad means to make the mother want to cure their kid. Now, have either of you ever watched Babylon 5?
No, I haven't.
No, I haven't either.
It's too bad. There's season one of Babylon 5 is kind of rough around the edges, but there's a really great episode in season one called Believers. And this story was very, very similar to that. So in that story, there's a couple, they come to the station and their kid is having trouble breathing. And the doctor, you know, examines him and says, oh, it's a small operation to remove this obstruction in his, you know, airway. But they forbid it because, you know, no one can be cut open because then their soul will escape, and their religion believes that. And I'm not going to spoil that episode. It ends much more tragically than this one does. And this one actually ends fairly tragically. So, you know, if you get a chance, you should watch that. But Peter David also had a lot of involvement in Babylon 5. He wrote a number of episodes. He didn't write that episode. That episode was actually written by David Gerrold, another Star Trek alumni. But I was kind of wondering if there might be a connection there. because Peter David worked on Babylon 5. And it actually, this episode would have come out around the same time because it was kind of 93, 94, I think, season one of Babylon 5 was. So I don't know. Just kind of an idle wondering for any listeners out there that are familiar with that episode. You know, did you guys kind of notice some similarities there? I'd be curious to hear what you think about that.
Yeah, I wish I'd seen that episode. I'd never seen it. I like this plot line a lot, but I gotta say though, you said the guy's name wrong. It's not Maz Marco, it's Maz Kanata.
Ah.
Every time I read it, I just kept saying Maz Kanata in my head, but anyways.
And for those who don't know, that's from Star Wars The Force Awakens.
I kind of wanted to keep shouting Maz Polo after every time I heard his name, but you know, Maz Marco, Maz Polo, but anyway.
Oh gosh. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we just found the title to this episode.
Maz Marco, Maz Polo.
Write that one down.
This was an interesting subplot as well, and it was a very Star Trek subplot. Like, this is something that you would definitely see in an episode. It's something believable for an episode that you would see on screen, and it's believable for Bashir's character. You know, this is a guy who doesn't want to say no when he thinks he can heal somebody. You know, I mean, look at the episode The Quickening, right, from Deep Space Nine, where he's just wants to heal him. Now, this one, he doesn't have to find the cure. There already is a cure. But in this, he pursues it with the same vigor of trying to convince this woman to have her son healed.
Yeah, he's very deceiving. I wasn't sure how I felt about this because I applaud him for wanting to save a life. But at the same time, you know, we are dealing with a rule that we have in the Federation. I mean, this is a religion. If they're not doing anything because of religious reasons to save their son, then we shouldn't get involved. I mean, their religion said that, what did we say, Coker, that Coker is going to make the decision whether he lives or dies. It's not their place to make that decision if he's going to survive this illness or not. But Bashir's doing everything he can to counter that and say, you know, basically, forget your religion and your beliefs, we can save your son. And he's not, I mean, again, you want to save a life, but he's going against their religion. I mean, and he's misleading the mother into a holosuite to see images of her son dying to convince her to show up to the infirmary and get this done. And I really thought at the end of this book he was going to catch a lot of crap for that from Sisko. And it's alluded to that he did get some crap from him, but I really expected a really powerful scene about whether we should go there or not.
Yeah, it's definitely very heavy-handed what Bashir does. And, you know, yeah, it's always noble to want to save a life. And, you know, that's very fitting in with what we know of Bashir and what we learn of him later. So, you know, kudos to Peter David for getting that character trait right. But yeah, it was definitely a little further than I was expecting him to go. And, but I was also expecting kind of the hammer to fall on him from Sisko, not the hammer to fall on him from the changeling. That's something else. And thankfully it doesn't happen to him, but yeah, no, it's definitely something that I thought, you know, for the setup we get with that, I think it could have used a little bit more exploration, a little more fallout. I would have really been interested to see that.
Yeah, I thought that I expected that. I expected it. Not that I want to see it. I expected it. And we didn't get that. So I was a little disappointed with that. But, I mean, the rest of the story I thought was fabulous. But it's interesting, too, that Maz Marco, Maz Polo, points out that, you know, they have similar laws themselves about non-interference. They don't interfere with their god. They do not decide what their god is going to do or not. They allow God to make that decision. So there's no interference in the decision of God. And so he's pointing that out to Bashir and Sisko that, you know, we don't interfere with our god. You shouldn't interfere with our religion. And you have similar laws, so you need to be following those laws. And Bashir didn't. And thankfully, yes, his, you know, this boy ends up living, but then the mother and the boy are abandoned by the father, because the father can't keep them as part of his, you know, I mean, he's like, what? He's like a priest or something or whatever, and he can't have them anymore. So he disowns them. They can't even come back to their own planet. So in a lot of ways, she sacrificed her family and her society and her loved ones just to save her son. And now she's on her own with him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was an interesting finale to that plot line. And it's not quite what you would expect out of a Star Trek story as well. You know, generally you expect happy endings when it comes to Star Trek for the most part. Just especially generally for the week-to-week episodes, right? But I liked it. I thought it was a satisfying ending. You know, it wasn't like a happy ending, but I thought it was satisfying for the storyline for sure. You know, and considering, like, it's interesting, this holy religion that they've got, and considering how they were described as basically looking like death, right? You know, like O'Brien makes the joke how they just need a sickle, right, earlier on in the book. But it's very satisfying. I liked it a lot.
Yeah, they had red glowing eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And they, you know, very dark characters with red glowing eyes, except for the sun was, you know, his skin was discoloring. Yeah, he was sick and he didn't have that glow in his eyes.
One argument that I kind of kept expecting to be made that never really came up was, you know, at the end, I really thought Bashir would make the argument that, you know, their god brought them to the station. So how did he not know that it was maybe part of their god's plan that they encounter Bashir, who is able to cure them or something like that? You know, it's almost a testament to Peter David and the writing that they didn't take that route, because I feel like that's almost a very rote Star Trek type argument. So I was like, oh, okay, here we go. They're going to convince him that, oh, okay, no, it was all part of his god's plan to bring him here. And they didn't do that. And it ended very tragically for that family, who are, you know, very obviously at loose ends. You know, the wife's kind of like, I don't know, I guess we'll go here. What does it matter? Which, you know, to me is a very tragic ending. You know, it's all hope is lost kind of thing. So, kudos to kind of sticking to that and wanting that darker ending.
Yeah, I agree. I was thinking the same thing when I read it. I expected them to say, how do you know what your god wants or what your god doesn't want? I mean, your god brought you here. You're here. There's an opportunity to heal your son. And obviously, this is a gift from God that we have this available. And that argument was never brought up. That was never brought into things. And that's something we discuss in religion all over this world, of, you know, people's perceptions of what it is their God wants or doesn't want, and what's given to them. Is it really from God or is it really from man? And that's not brought about by God. I mean, so these debates go on all the time, and I did expect to see a little bit of that in here, but I enjoyed the fact that Bashir was determined to do what he wanted to do. I just questioned if it was the right thing to do.
So we haven't really talked about what the main plot of this story is, what the main antagonist is. And it turns out that there's this, I guess you could call him a changeling or a shapeshifter of some kind. It's never really explicitly stated that he is definitely one of Odo's people, but he's some sort of metamorph, some sort of shapeshifting entity who's come aboard the station, and he's an absolute psychopath. So he kills, and they try to find a motive for his killing, and he doesn't really have one. He just enjoys it. It's what he's always done. So, you know, this shapeshifter, this changeling, this whatever he is running amok on the station, killing people, you know, basically a serial killer shapeshifter, which is pretty terrifying. And so everyone on Deep Space Nine is, of course, trapped aboard the station because they can't let anyone go. And yeah, what did you guys think about his character and the role he played in the story?
There's a really interesting retcon that I like in this book that I like to especially now think about. Now, I'm going to give a little bit of a spoiler warning here. If you guys, I know you have, but if anybody listening hasn't read the David Mack Parallel Universe Section 31 novel, the last one that came out, right? I'm going to give a spoiler for that, so you might want to come back in a second if you haven't read that yet. But in that book, they give an explanation for why Odo is so different from the rest of the changelings, but why they're similar, right? So, and in this book, the theory is that our Odo came from the mirror universe, right? And so in our universe, they're all, the changelings are all like, they want to take over and they're all psychopaths and they want to dominate. And so this character kind of fits in with that. So in my headcanon, he actually is a member of Odo's species. So when you get to the other parallel universe, they're all law and order and play by the rules. And so that's where our Odo came from, is the mirror universe changelings, right? And so there was a cross when he went over, and it's, and so it explains why in crossover, when you go to see the Odo over there, he's all crazy running that, you know, that ore processing station, right? So those who've read the book will know what I'm talking about. But so to me, it fits with that continuity that this guy might be a crazy changeling, right? So I like that a lot, and I think it fits with other novels later on. I don't know. What do you guys think about that?
That's so awesome. I'm glad you pointed that out. That's why I like listening to the show. Oh, wait, I'm on it too. But that's why I like listening to the show.
Yeah, no, I kind of had that same thought, and I've always loved that explanation. And it's kind of in that novel just given as kind of a throwaway, like, huh, I wonder if maybe they got switched at some point. Oh, weird. And then they move on. And I remember reading that and going, oh, of course.
This is a great, great retcon. I love it.
Brilliant.
You know, and
yeah, it's such a brilliant move. I love that. Yeah.
Oh, man. It makes me want to go back and reread that again.
Anywho.
Yeah, no. So, yeah, his character, like we said, he's just a serial killer, just a murderer, and is absolutely crazy. One thing that I thought was really interesting, and of course, spoilers, we're talking about the book, we're spoiling the whole thing rotten. It's been out for years. You should have read it by now, unlike me who just read it. the ending, like how this villain died. And again, we've talked about kind of how Peter David does things. And this is something that felt very familiar to me from Peter David books, this kind of horrific ending where he falls through the wormhole. And of course, the wormhole's doing its thing and it's being all violent and crazy, subspace compression, right? I think they call it. And he comes out the other end in a million pieces. But he's not really dead. They're just individually all conscious and aware.
Yes. That was cool.
Oh, man.
That was cool.
So he's just going to float as individual molecules through the vacuum for possibly billions of years, unable to do anything.
How do you, in pieces, as this shapeshifter changeling, get your pieces all back together when they're floating around in space? I mean, it's just infinite. I mean, he'll just be out there as long as he can live, and they can never put himself back together. Didn't they even say he's a Humpty Dumpty? Or am I imagining that? They couldn't put all the pieces back together again.
I don't remember that part.
It could be.
Okay, maybe maybe that was in my mind, but it made me think of Humpty Dumpty.
I just was thinking about the ending to like the Lawnmower Man, when like if the computer just gets like the computer program of the guy just gets like evaporated or whatever. But
but yeah, going by physics, you know, there's just no way he can bring himself back together again. He's just going to drift further and further apart, and that's brutal. I don't know. Have you guys read the novel Vendetta?
Oh yes.
No, I haven't.
Oh, okay. Well, I won't spoil the ending then for you or the listeners who haven't read Vendetta, but there's kind of a similar ending. Not the same as this, but just that similar idea where the antagonist just has this kind of horrific undoing that just is pretty brutal and pretty final. So
yes, I think we will be reading that novel at some point on the show. Absolutely. It's on the list of to-do because that was one of my favorite novels back in the day, and I haven't read that in forever. So I want to see if that still holds.
That's great, because that'll give me a chance to finally read it.
There you go. Definitely.
Yeah, it's a good one. I actually only read it a few years ago, and it's excellent.
I know, because I read your review just the other day, actually, that you posted, I think, in 2011. That's how long ago it was, I think. So, or 13
Yeah,
or
that's
something like that.
That's the year I first started that website, so that's a pretty old review. How bad was my writing back then? Don't tell me.
You spelled the wrong.
Oh, darn it, again.
I don't know. The whole review was all in pieces. It just couldn't put it all back together again.
Slowly drifting apart. Yeah. Well, on that note, what are your kind of final thoughts and maybe a rating for Deep Space Nine number 2, The Siege? Brandon, why don't you go?
I like this book a lot. I'm really glad that we reread it for this. It's interesting to read it after so many years of the series being over, having watched the series so many times. It really feels like it could fit perfectly in somewhere in the first season. And Peter David's my favorite Star Trek writer. I think he's absolutely fantastic. And it's nice to have a light read. Like, it's not a long, complicated read. It's a shorter novel. And sometimes it's fun to read those. I like it a lot. I'm going to give it one viewing of Triple X Program number 3.
Excellent.
Okay, so I don't recall that much the first time I read it back in 1993 when I was just a young lad, but and I had forgotten that this was a Peter David book until I picked it up and was like, oh yeah, I forgot Peter David wrote this. And I have to say, I really enjoyed this. It's probably not my favorite of his books, but it's up there. And it was great to go back to the old Deep Space Nine because a lot of the novels take place after the series. So I would give this 4.5 out of 5 O'Brien magic tricks.
Is that a good rating? Because although actually he did do the trick right. It's just that Odo was very unimpressed.
Yeah, well, because he put the cards down and he says, now pick a card. And Odo looks and he goes, yeah, okay. And O'Brien's like, okay, now look at your card. And Odo's just staring at the deck. And O'Brien's like, well, look at the card. He goes, I am. I'm looking at the card. No, pick it up and look at it.
Is this your card? No. They're your cards. That doesn't make any sense. yeah, that was cute. But yeah, no, I really enjoyed this one as well. I really appreciate Peter David's irreverent style of writing. And to tackle Deep Space Nine so early on in its run and to get so many things right, I think is not only a testament to Peter David's writing, but I would say probably also a testament to how well the creators of Deep Space Nine got the characters fully fleshed out in the series Bible before it even started, because so many of those character notes are bang on. And to be able to extrapolate from that to create these characters and get so much of it right is just really, really impressive. Again, the uber nerd in me can pick little tiny things here and there, but the tapestry as a whole is just beautiful. Like, it was a really well done book. Couple little issues here and there don't detract from a really fun, really interesting story, with some parts that really made me think deeper than I thought this book would have me do. So I think I would have to give this one 4 out of 5 cards that aren't Odo's. Definitely a good novel.
Well, I'm so glad that we read that novel because I love Peter David books, and this one was right up there. And again, one of my favorite lines, I don't even remember who said it in the book, says, Quark, you son of a space cow. I'm going to use that from now on, you son of a space cow.
I've been seeing your Facebook updates lately. You've been calling a lot of people space cows. I think you've gone a little crazy with that.
I've lost a lot of friends.
Well, space cows aren't the only things we've been discussing on the Trek FM network. So here's a quick look at other things that we've been talking about on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
My casting choices, okay, would be for Ruck, you got to go with Dave Bautista, right? He's Drax in Guardians of the Galaxy. He played Jinx in...
Yeah, Inspector.
Yeah, was that Jinx? What's his name? Hinks, Mr.
Hinks. Ooh, Mr. Hinks. Yeah, Mr. Hinks.
That's the wrong James Bond film, everybody.
The 602 Club.
Going back to the Gotham thing really quickly, I know this is semi-derailing. Why would you want to move to Gotham? I mean, he has to have been there. It's like the picture that he has on his wall is this beautiful, shining, like, daytime view, if I'm not mistaken, of Gotham, which I don't think we ever see. It was like, I'm not really sure. Charm City looks quite nice. Like, so.
Saturday Morning Trek.
It's very much like a continuation of the original series.
You know what? You raise a very good point, and it's one we probably should have talked about earlier, is that we talk so much about the animation and the limitations of the medium that we forget about the writing. And overall, it's pretty strong throughout the run.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out those shows. You can find them wherever you get your podcasts. If you're on iTunes, search for our podcasts there. And while you're there, give us a star rating and review if you have the time. That really helps us rise up in the search results and helps Trekkies everywhere find their favorite podcasts. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find us on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, basically any of the podcatchers that you normally use to listen to your favorite podcasts. Another way you can help keep all of our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all the great perks we have for you. These perks can include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats on our content development team, and more. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. We'd like to thank our associate producers, Ken Tripp, Greg Rozier, some dude named Brandon Shemutala, and Norman Lau for their support of the Trek FM
that
network.
Brandon Shemutala, he's a son of a space cow.
Oh, that guy, I tell you. Oh, I didn't realize you were still here. Huh.
Thank you, Brandon. Thank you.
Thank you so much for being an associate producer on Literary Treks. We really appreciate it. Well, before we go, Brandon, why don't you tell everybody where they can find you?
Well, and I'm not in Quark's Hollow Suites. You can find me here on the network with new episodes of Melodic Treks and new episodes of Warp 5. Having lots of fun over there on the Annex 01. You can follow me on Twitter at Brandon Metella. And I'm slowly juggling and starting to get another podcast started, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast. So if you want to check out my Twitter account, which has been set up, it's at Good Evening Pod. You can find me every once in a while poking my head up in the Babel conference, and I'm the Patreon manager for the network. So if you have questions about, Patreon or anything like that, you can get in touch with me. And Bruce, where can people find you when you're not doing a terrible job at doing magic tricks?
Well, you can find me on the streets begging for money, or you can find me on Twitter at @Admiral_Rex. And you can also find me on the Star Wars Report podcast, where we talk about, Star Wars. You can check me out there with Riley Blanton and Mark Herleman. And you can always find me in the Babel Conference, because if I'm not posting anything in there, oh my, yes, I am reading what all you fun people are posting in there and having a good time reading it. And so, Dan, let me ask you, if when you're not saying Odo looks a little pale, where can people find you?
Well, you can find me on Twitter. I'm at Kertrats. That's KERTRATS. You can find me on youtube.com/Kertrats Productions, facebook.com/Kertrats Productions. You can probably find me on Reddit. I'm a Kertrats there. I'm Kertrats everywhere. Just search Kertrats, you'll find me. And chances are that wherever you find me, I'll be talking about Star Trek.
That would really suck if Odo were to kick the bucket.
Oh, man. Yeah, those were pretty bad. But I appreciate a good pun, so that was fun. Well, thank you all so much for listening. And until next time,
live long
and read on.
What do you call that, light reading?
To each his own, number one.